wanted to take it back to the previous step and say, essentially, do we have to have nuclear energy? And is not the cost that we pay for that, not mainly financial, but in terms of its impact on the environment and on the biosphere, and various other arguments in that connection, aren't they so great that we should simply go the no nukes direction? And so tonight's forum is going to be more genuinely a forum in the sense that we won't have any presentations as such, but we'll simply try to respond to whatever questions or concerns or anxieties or whatever any of you might feel and might like to express. We've got Leo and Rudy here tonight. We were both here the other night. Leo will be leaving tomorrow, so we wanted to take advantage of his being here. And Paul Swanson, we're adding to our discussion tonight. He is a physics professor at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, right?
Previously.
Oh, that's right. He was. He's now with John Deere and Company, who don't make anything nuclear as far as I know.
Not yet. Yeah.
They paint it green and yellow, don't they?
Yeah.
Not with a nuclear garden tractor. Okay.
5 years from now.
Yeah. So that's all we're going to say in terms of introduction, and just ask who's got a question that they want to get started with. Bill Simpkin also can be
Bill
in here.
Us.
He was with us the other night. So.
Well, this is a continuation of...
Yes, right. This is phase two. There'll still be time. We're going to cut it off pretty much, I'd say, at 20 minutes after 9, which will be just 40 minutes from now. John?
Some of the things that Leo said the other night, I gained the clear impression, at least from him, that he felt nuclear was really the only way to go in the very near future. You know, and he said that the coal situation, you know, which we see a lot of publicity about nowadays, about really cranking up the mining coal again, burning that again for energy, but you kind of ran that down the other night and seemed to indicate that you at least felt the nuclear was the way we needed to go. Is that true? Is that assumption right?
A qualified yes. You have to assess your sources and what you want to do. As you look over the next 20 years, and as I have looked at the next 20 years, although I don't plan to live that long, I'm concerned about my children, I'm concerned about those who are younger. You can run through the whole gamut of your sources of energy. Now you can say no growth, but you're also making a very serious decision affecting a lot of people. Depends on how many people you want to feed, and how many jobs you want. And then this I'm considering also the third world and feeding them. So right now, as I see it, there are only two viable sources of any consequence. As you run down the list, water power, there isn't much left of that. You can't burn all the trees, although I have great hopes for the biosphere relative to the future as far as increasing this utilization of solar energy, that is a rate of utilizing the biomass. And I think the recent views of Phil Abelson, who I visited with not long ago, relative to this, and I've given this a good deal of thought, and I think there's some hope there. But as a viable large source in the near future, and I'm talking now in the 20-year time frame, that is not a great source. Geothermal will give us some, but it is not without hazard, and it's limited in its ability to give us this. So there's a lot of solar we can use right now in a relatively small way as far as its contribution to the overall energy need. Fusion, we couldn't see, I don't think, and some of the physicists here, at least the estimates I have heard and talked with some of those in fusion research. I wouldn't expect to see a fusion reactor that's commercial in the next 20 years of great consequence as far as a contributor. I think it's a crime against humanity the way we're using burning up oil right now, because I am more concerned with things that can't be used for something else that you use for energy, or something that you can get some more of. That brings it down to the tides. There isn't too much of that, and I think there is a great effort, of course, in developing solar. I think we can do more with wind and solar, but as far as being a substantial contributor in the short term, I don't think we have it. And if you then are going to feed the people and also prevent a revolution within the next 10 to 20 years, you have to go with everything we got, plus energy conservation. I think it's very important. But then you have coal and nuclear as the two viable sources. Now, I suppose ideally, when people look at the energy source, they say, well, why can't we get fusion? Well, in the short term, I would hope that this kind of a thing were possible. The societal cost, however, by the estimates of some, I think, knowledgeable people, is substantial. That probably the next best thing might be a breeder reactor as far as source of fuel, looking at the long-term source of fuel, you see. But a lot of people are opposed to the breeder reactor. Some of them are already functioning and doing quite well. The one in France, I think, has done quite well, except for mechanical difficulties not associated with the nuclear portion. And so it comes down then to the choice of coal. If I had a choice, if you asked me, would I want my power with the energy generating system in my backyard or very near it? If you give me a choice, under the present technology, I would choose a nuclear reactor to a coal, if that were my choice, yes. On the basis of hazard and the cost of human life in the short, long term. On the basis of what I studied and learned in the last 30 years, to answer your question.
Yeah.
Isn't it true that the thing that's really holding back nuclear technology today is the lack of an advanced understanding of turbine technology? That, I mean, theoretically, the power from the atom is unlimited, and we ought to be able to just turn turbines till they go out of style. But isn't it that we just don't know enough how to gear turbine technology to do whatever it takes to produce electricity? Is that the thing that's holding us back partly as far as cranking out the wattage, so to speak, out of nuclear reactors?
Well, you can get an efficiency. I think this is one of the things you're getting at, and some of you will address this. Right now, I suppose nuclear is maybe 30% efficient. Coal is in a good system, is probably 38 or 40%, maybe, is it?
Somewhere about there. Right?
Pardon?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it can be a lot more done. Now, if I were a dictator, I wouldn't run the nuclear energy program the way it's being run now. I would be far more demanding of the kind of person I had working on it, and what I require of that person. I think the Three Mile Island thing is a sad commentary. It does say something that even with all the mistakes they made, nobody was really hurt by it. But you can compare that, for example, with all the nuclear reactors that they have in the whole naval program. That Rickover has. Now they have a very strict program, and probably the lowest bidder didn't build it, and that's a problem, of course. And profits was not a motive. And he interviewed most of the significant people there. And if you've ever interviewed with Rickover, once is enough. It's a very demanding system, and probably there's a light goes on in his office whenever a reactor is haywire, and somebody better do something about it. So I think there's a lot more that can be done, and much of the failure in the systems is in the mechanical end of things. and that's, for example, the breeder reactor in France. The trouble they were having with valves and all this kind. Now, you know, you physicists and engineers can address this further, because this is a very important question.
if you want to.
Go ahead.
No, I don't want to say anything.
Well, I just would comment that my background has not been in the area of turbine technology, but I would say that that's probably true, that turbine technology is in the process of growth right now, and hopefully that there will be some new breakthroughs. There are new materials being used in turbines now, ceramic materials that are trying so they can go to much higher temperature operation than they have in the past, which may hold some possibility for better turbine design. But unless somebody else can help me out, I don't really know of
this also extends to wind power, too, to get a better system for that, to have a better conversion. If you've seen some of these wind power things, and there have been some late developments that, you know, you give more, you have a little more faith in having a bigger contribution from it.
Part of the reason I ask that is, to me, that points us to the fact that what it seems to me we're doing with nuclear power is like using a flamethrower to light our cigarettes. We got a lot of power there, but we don't have the mechanical technology to take full advantage of it. And I would question, on the other hand, the whole nuclear thing anyway, but at this point, we seem to be, you know, a vast reservoir of power that can't be harnessed with present technology. We're way beyond our bounds in that respect.
Well, it isn't that far away in percentage efficiency from coal or oil.
Right.
Percentage-wise, it isn't that far away from it.
That's right.
From the heat output, because it's a thermal situation, isn't it?
Right.
It's a thermal conversion, and you're not that far away, and some of the new, I think they were shooting for a higher percentage that approaches that of coal.
Right. The breeder reactor, I think, is supposed to get up to somewhere around 39 or 40% efficient, a little bit over 40% efficient, so that would put it slightly better than coal, then, in terms of its thermal efficiency.
Other questions?
Yeah.
I was reading that the expense involved in building a nuclear reactor, and then it has about a 20-year lifespan. Now, how would that compare with something that would use coal? You know, as far as the lifespan and the cost to the public.
Excuse me. I believe it's 40 years both for coal and for nuclear,
mm-hmm.
not 20.
I had
the nuclear
read
plant
20,
is supposed to be last to 40 years, the same as the coal plant.
The reactors that I know most about are the earlier type. I lived one near one for 15 years, and I didn't have much to do with it except I knew how to operate it, because I was in my life has been chiefly in looking at the bioenvironmental impact. The effect on animals and people as a result of energy utilization, the effluent from energy utilization. But the reactor I was near, I think Enrico Fermi drew out the first plan on the back of a matchbook cover. and it was about the second or third production reactor built. And it was built in 1944. And when I left there, 20 years later, it was still operating. They were going to close it down, but not because it was working, because they had better systems. But it could have gone on for quite a while. But it was like a model, a Model T Ford probably. And they have much better systems, more sophisticated ones, and far safer ones.
Do any of you know the answer to the question of the relative cost of a nuclear unit compared to coal?
Well, the economics, of course, dictate right now.
Today, I can add that today, 1 kilowatt produced by coal, the construction of a plant that uses coal runs, you can go as low as $100 per kilowatt. Especially in the South, where you don't have to use a protective shield because of the, like in Arizona or New Mexico. So it's about, let's say, 100. Whereas the cost of nuclear energy per kilowatt per construction now has gone up about 1,000. When you talk about 1,000 megawatt, which is 1 million kilowatt output today costs certainly about $1 billion.
Yeah.
That means $1,000 per kilowatt output.
Mm-hmm.
So it costs about 10 times more than the average cost of the coal fuel.
Leo, I'm interested to know, given what you've studied and you know about the effects of radiation on plant animal life,
yes,
human life, so forth, do we know, can you say, what the impact on human life was in the area, 20-mile radius of the 3-mile island thing, given that some of these gases that were emitted either intentionally or accidentally were radioactive, had particles, the effect on the people that were working in the plant involved in, during this couple weeks of the time of the accident. Can we say, do we know what the long-term impact of that radiation is going to be?
To an extent, if you tell me what the values are and what the nature of the substance was, I wish I had that for you. I have some friends who are involved in that study now, but I do not have the data as far as the emissions. The emissions that I heard of, like radioiodine, was a great concern for them. The information you heard in the papers was incorrect, or if you listen to Face the Nation, because the information they had there, they said that, well, radioiodine was the big factor because it is a volatile, and they said it's 17 million year half life or something, and that's a big trouble. There is an isotope of iodine, which is I-129, which has a very long half life, but it is such low radioactivity relative to its stable effect that it will block the uptake of the thyroid before it reaches a level that will damage the thyroid. The main radioisotopes of radioiodine that are of concern in a release such as this are I-131, I-133, and I-135. The longest lived of those are 8 days, and the biggest contributor as far as most energetic are I-133 and 135, who are in somewhat larger quantities. The amounts that were released there, I don't expect that you'll ever be able to see an effect. I have worked with radioiodine in some animals in very high levels down to low levels. The longest experiment was 12 years in sheep of a daily administration. So we have a pretty good handle on this. We also have a good deal of data on people, because a lot of people have had radioiodine, and they've been exposed to it, and some of them therapeutically. They have also had their thyroid radiated, unfortunately, in early days, and for other reasons. And they have caused, radiation will cause thyroid tumors. At substantial levels. We had an experiment on radioiodine in the South Pacific at the time of the detonation of the first hydrogen bomb, when some fallout fell on Ronjalap, Rondrik, and Alingini. And those people have been followed up, and many of those people who were close in had thyroid adenomas and were removed. Some of them were brought to this country. Now, the radiation dose there, of course, was in thousands they had a whole body radiation dose of I think 100. I'd have to look up the data, but between 100 and, well, probably up to 200 R, whole body radiation, which is bad news. and that goes also to the thyroid. And the difference in effectiveness of an X-ray dose to the thyroid versus radioiodine is about a factor of 5 to 10. They used to figure a factor of 10. So that would be worth, in a beta radiation from the thyroid, from radioiodine, would be 1,000, probably at least 1,000 rad to the thyroid, and then from radioiodine probably another 1,500 or 2,000. So you're talking about a big dose. I imagine the radiation dose to the people, just as a guess, I suppose it might be millirads to maybe a few rads. Now you have to then, if you're going to say, well, the thyroid tumors that you might see in these people 20 years down the line or 30 years down the line, you have to separate out the exposure that the thyroid has received from other types of radiation. If you take a whole chest body x-ray and they do it from here, you get up to 100 millirad. If they fluoroscope you, if you have a total mouth x-ray every year and it isn't quite cone down right, you probably get 5, maybe, depends on now their system they're using, 5, 10, 15 R to the thyroid, and it's sudden. So chances are you probably won't be able to find it from this.
Is this the only thing we're worried about, though, is people with thyroid glands?
No.
Is there any other dangers? What about genetic dangers? What about other possible effects of radiation? Is there anybody in America that can tell me specifically, based on data, what was the effect of that Three Mile Island accident? Do we know?
Yeah, nobody can tell you.
Well, there is a... I challenge that. I challenge it on this basis that if you can tell me, if you tell me what the releases were and the exposure, I can.
But do we know? How are we going to find that out?
Well, they had, and I'll know better when the site survey teams go. But they had, they have to have air monitors there.
Yes.
And. They can tell by the, so they have these readings by air monitors, by dosimeters around there, and they can give you readings. And everybody in the plant or associated with it had to have very sophisticated meters on them that gives their total exposure. And on that basis, knowing the dose effect relationship, and there's a lot of data available that says with this kind of a dose, you get this kind of an effect. There's a lot of data on that. And you can come fairly close in saying what the impact of this will be. And much of the data, predictive data, of course, is based on higher exposures extended down on a linear extrapolation. That is, if you had 100. If you had 50% dying with 500 R, and if you reduce that down to 250 R, you have a certain number dying. If it's linear, it would be 250, you see, and half of that if you cut it in half, you see. Well, that's for acute, that isn't how the dose effect works, but that's how they used for prediction on a linear extrapolation. That says, for example, that if you have a 200 mile an hour wind and you kill 200 people with it, if you have a 100 mile an hour wind, you kill 100 people. If you have a 10 mile an hour wind, you kill 10 people. And if you have a 1 mile an hour wind, you kill one person. That's what they use in prediction. It doesn't work quite that way because most toxins, whether it's radiation, physical agents, or chemical agents, is a sigmoid curve. That is, lower effect with low doses. There are a few exceptions to this, and one of them is probably neutrons. There was no neutron release outside the planet.
So far, to my knowledge, the only gases, radioactive gases proven to have escaped from the auxiliary building were rare gases.
Yeah.
That were just the xenon and helium.
Krypton, probably. Krypton, a little krypton.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those rare gases that go very high in the atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah,
and therefore, maybe nobody knows which area has ever been contaminated. Certainly not the area immediately around the plant.
Not from krypton. No. And
probably nobody would be contaminated.
Although I don't expect that you ever find an effect from that region. On the preliminary information I have.
I'd like to put the question in another way. Why people are, or else, why there are people scared of nuclear energy? What they are scared of? What facts they have that tell them that nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. I qualify that.
Oh, yes, that's great.
Because nuclear energy as a weapon, I'm scared myself, and I believe everybody, the one who's not scared is a fool.
Yeah, well stated.
But between nuclear energy as a weapon and nuclear energy for peace, there is a world of difference.
Could
now, my question is, why are people, or there are people scared of nuclear energy used for peace?
I hear that kind of as a question directed to the whole group. Can we get some answers?
Can I get somebody, somebody can tell me a fact that scare him of
they,
nuclear energy?
If they don't tell you, I'll tell you the issues that have been brought to me, but I'd like to have them say it.
Right, first I'd like them to say it.
Yeah.
Okay, one in the back, and then one over there.
And one here. I've administered film to high school students on the nuclear energy question, having PhDs in physics stating their views, and there are people on both sides. And my big concern is that I don't think the waste has, question has been solved. What do we do with what's left over? And another question is, I think something I don't know if my information from the news media is accurate or wherever I kind of put it together, but plutonium being falling into the wrong hands or other radioactive materials which if gathered and put together with information that's readily available in anybody's library may not hold a belief. Getting to some unsophisticated nation and not being used.
So we have the waste issue and the proliferation issue here. Can we add what was?
We live in a city between two nuclear plants, and there's not too, there isn't any dissatisfaction or any fright. And since we've heard Leo the other night telling us we should be more afraid of the chlorine gas that goes through.
Okay. Here?
I guess I have a concern about it as far as whether it's wise if we're really gluttons for energy, but another concern as far as fear is the fact that this nuclear energy is being put together by people, the same people who brought us Skylab that's going to be dropping down somewhere, nobody knows where. And so I have a basic, I guess, mistrust or fear about just what people can do. Plumbing things go wrong and can happen in a very sophisticated system. And so I think, with very basic mechanical kinds of problems can come. We talk about relative safety. Well, I need to be more than relatively safe. I like to be more certain than that. And so when we're dealing with something that has that kind of potential for damaging life, I really wonder if we really need it.
Okay, one more over here.
So this is a people kind of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to keep track of this so we can address these and you can address them.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I don't have a fear of nuclear energy, but I think we ought to look a little bit at it on the aspect of when you take something like solar, where the control is for, say, nuclear or coal power plants, you're dependent on the power companies, and then you're also dependent on the government for the protection of those. Whereas something like solar or wind or water that you might be able to set up on an individual basis, you have some control over that yourself and have more flexibility that way.
I got to remember that.
That would be kind of the central station power as opposed
versus
to
the small unit.
Diversified. Carol?
I think the greatest fear that I detect from public from publications and from just conversations that you hear on television is that since nuclear energy is connected in the public mind with radiation, radiation causes cancer. People are scared more about cancer than any other kind of death, and that's why they're afraid of nuclear energy.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a fairly significant load so far.
Solar is a question mark.
Okay.
I didn't really have a question. Well, I just had
we can't take very many more before we can address these, and then we'll start the next batch, because when you get old, there's three things that happen to you.
Memory goes first.
John, I can't remember the other one more.
I'm scared on two counts. One is, I'm not convinced, and I just haven't seen anything that convinces me, that we're operating within the confines of our knowledge about nuclear technology. The second reason, and part of that is, it seems to me that the general public reads nuclear power as a blank check for energy. We need energy, we want energy, the source of the atom is unlimited, let's build nuclear reactors and we can get it. And I think that's terribly dangerous, because as somebody said, it makes us gluttons for energy. And that kind of gluttony for energy is going to turn back on us, because we're going to overstep ourselves in the production of reactors. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd reaffirm everything everybody has said so far as things that frighten me as well.
All right, let's take them in order.
Oh, Chuck's got
something. Oh, tied into that one, a premature technology and a national commitment to the kind of thing. It could be in 10 years with the development of a better understanding of the whole thing, it would be left with a whole system that is outdated. And that it seems like we often make premature national commitments with great expense. And it's a political issue that satisfies the gluttony of the people, and I think it's terribly poor leadership.
Okay, that ought to be enough to start with.
All right, now, can you remember more? The lady over
waste
there.
Waste issue.
The waste issue, we discussed the other night, and can we just have you go to the tape, and then you can ask me questions. Is that fair enough, rather than to try to summarize for you?
You don't need to summarize it. I saw the films, and one PhD student said this, and the other PhD student said this, and they did not agree on whether it was safe. I mean, one said it was definitely safe, and the other said it was definitely not safe.
And we did not have both sides the other night. Mm-hmm. I mean, the tape is one side. So you have to get the other experts.
Is it?
The other night had no great criticism of nuclear waste.
Well, I'll criticize it right now. Huh? I don't, just because I'm working in it and people have come up to me and accused me of being pro-nuclear, I see it, just because I'm working in it doesn't mean I believe in it. I think it's a real problem. I think it's something that should have been taken care of before we even got into any of this stuff. And I agree with also that we have somewhat overstepped our bounds in that we were so fascinated by this technology of getting these nuclear plants underway that nobody really figured out what we were going to do with all the stuff that's left over. I'm upset about that. I'm trying to do something about that, but I still think it's a big problem. That's enough itself to scare me about it. Well, so there's the other side. I don't want to.
Yeah, of course, the other night we said, I said, you know, we had some of the technology. They should have pushed ahead further so that we were further along. But I also said that the quantities that are hazardous are not yet that large that with the developing technology they can come up with a better system. Now you can argue whether they should have had a lot of that to provide for it. As far as representing a hazard as of now, I do not regard it as a present hazard of the quantities with what we know that we can do with it. Now for the long haul, we got to have a better system.
I think all she's saying, Leo, and I agree with her, is some people who are experts disagreed with you, and we didn't have that input the other night. I'm not asking you to repeat your speech because I respect you. We did not have the other side. We did not have a debate.
Yeah.
And the films and the books.
That's true.
The
no, I agree.
Talk and pictures of and Getty being given the contract for 5 years to solve the problem in New York and ending by saying we do not know how to get rid of the waste, and Harry Reisner saying that to the U.S. public. We didn't have a lot of that input the other night. I think that's all she's saying.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
So in the minds of many people, that's still a major problem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I won't say that it isn't a problem. But we have technology that can handle it.
I hope they dump it in your backyard.
We have locations. We have developed and we've been handling encapsulated radioactive material for a very long time, and we've handled it safely in very high levels. Just a lot of radioactivity, and we've handled it very safely.
Well, but my answer to that is, why is it then that the Department of Energy has billions of dollars of contracts out right now for somebody to find one site for some of this stuff?
Yep.
The Sandia site, they haven't got anything in there yet. Good, to my knowledge at all. And that was supposed to be one of the better sites. The Salina, Kansas site blew up.
Well, that was a poor choice to begin with.
Well, yeah, but whose choice was it to begin with?
Well, I think that they haven't done well as far as using good heads on that.
But I...
better than the other night.
No, but what I'm saying is that it just seems really strange to me. I know from what little I know about this now, and talk to me in about 3 years and I'll know a lot about it, but it seems to me, and I've talked this with Rudy, that the type of sites that they're looking for this stuff, that are going to be impregnable, that are going to be able to take the waste, stick it in the ground and forget about it, and forget about whether we're taken over by the Russians or anybody else in the meantime, I mean, put it away and forget about it. We haven't got that kind of a site. Every site that we've looked at has had problems. I mean, when we do have problems in this area, and I think people have a genuine fear. I have a right to that fear.
Yeah, I think part of the fear is nobody wants it in their backyard.
Well, yeah, that too.
I guess I've worked with it so long and had it in my backyard that we handled it safely under those circumstances. And even if I were still working at Hanford Laboratories, I would not have any trouble in encapsulating it the way we did and sending some stuff up into space, encapsulate it on top of the ground, you know, and have it there. And we'd know what was there.
Sure.
And I don't have any trouble with that.
You want to say something?
Yeah, I would like to make a couple comments here. I guess the last time we went around on this, it was a little one-sided, but in some respects, I guess my view as a physicist is that I have some real concerns about the radioactive waste storage problem, and consequently, because of these concerns, and because I don't have any answers, and the people that I've talked with yet, there's still a lot of debate about exactly what is the best solution, and we don't really have a good solution. I'm just more or less had to throw up my hands and say that the only thing I can see for nuclear power is a short-term solution to our energy needs, and that we better get on with some alternative energy studies, solar, wind, and other sources to take over so that we don't have to deal with this in the year 2000 or 2020 with a great big huge radioactive waste problem.
Excuse me now, you as a physicist, can we honestly believe that the solar energy can ever substitute other major sources of energy?
Not by itself, no.
That's enough.
Mm. Not
by itself,
no.
It depends how much energy we want.
I would think it's time to stop cheating the American people, telling them that with the solar energy we have the magic rod. With the solar energy we don't do nothing.
That's right. We don't,
that's the point.
By itself, that's not enough.
By itself is nothing.
That's right.
Let's take through these questions.
Yes, I think we have 5 minutes left. I think that'd be a minute for each one.
Yeah, we got to go fast. We got to go fast. And I'm available until I leave on the bus tomorrow at 1:30. I'm back in the last of August and for the first couple of weeks in September, if any of you are still here. But don't write me letters because I'm busy writing a book right now and I have to have it ready before probably I come up here. So unless you want a fast answer. Now, you said you relied on the press. That was another issue that I think that's very critical. And I have had a lot of traffic with the press, and I have given up almost completely as far as getting a, a straight story on anything that I had firsthand knowledge of. And on this, I know that they were going to give up, for example, a very typical case, a balanced view of nuclear power. And so they had one view, how terrible it was, and they said, well, you come to, they said, can we come to your laboratory at the University of California and get how you view nuclear power? And so they came over and got our nuclear power, and he wrote a very good article. And I thought it was a very balanced view showing both sides. And on Sunday, when it came out in the Sacramento Bee, it was only one side, and we weren't in it. This is not atypical. Terror sells, and bad people have a penchant for bad news. This is the nature of people today. And I believe very little of it. And usually the people they copy are people, and they call them, and I can name some of them for you, and I know the people. And they don't know tiddly-dee about it. You know, they and I don't know what their motivation is. But they don't even know the basic fundamentals of radiation. And I could document that for you. Now, the third thing you raised was...
proliferation.
Proliferation. The possibility of the radioactive materials, plutonium is the thing that came to mind.
Yeah.
Falling into the wrong hands.
Yeah, and making a device in your backyard. That's a bit difficult to make one in your own backyard without anybody knowing it. Unless you have weapons grade, and that's hard
that
to come
TV
by.
What was that TV show that you used to have on all the time, Mission Impossible?
Yeah.
That kind of thing where some other country...
That's true for that, and it's true for a lot of other things, because we've seen terrorists almost compromised without nuclear energy or a plutonium bomb. They almost compromised Italy, and I can write a scenario for you of compromising this country, and I wouldn't need a nuclear device.
But that doesn't scare you?
I do that, not
well,
fact.
Well, it
I
concerns.
For fact.
It concerns.
I haven't heard any fact. How many people have been killed by nuclear? They may be killed in the future.
But it's not possible that somebody can take plutonium and do that?
The chances... I tell you, I'm more afraid of countries that develop and use it that way. On the scale of
if you want to be scared, I tell you, I can scare you many, many other ways, much more than nuclear energy. Every jet that leaves New York, every jumbo jet leaving New York, consumes a certain amount of oxygen, irreversible. Means the oxygen is combined with carbon, forming a chemical combination which is irreversible. So we lose certain amount of oxygen from our total amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. Making calculations, which is easy with the slide ruler, that's the computer, in 200 years, if you go at this pace, the atmosphere in the whole globe will be not breathable anymore. That's enough of being scared, everybody. Right?
You scare me more in a lot of ways. But
why never heard that? Why everybody increase more jumbo jets and more Concorde and so on?
Yeah, I should point out that none of us will get out of this place alive. let's run through them more now. The people problem, it is a problem. In any technology, and as we advance in technology, and more and more, I'm afraid that people are not conscientious. Many of them are not conscientious about devotion to their work, as far as really paying attention and being fully trained for competence, whether it's in this field or a lot of others. And if I were running, I don't care what program it is, and in my own situation, I try to do better at this, as far as, you know, facing up to your responsibilities for a given position. And this does concern me with the level of technology. My preference for a living situation would be to build a community at Lucerne and live there and be totally independent of most everything, you know. But that is not within the realm of possibility for the populations we have on Earth today.
The cancer question.
And the cancer question, the concern with radiation from cancer, the present radiation exposures at the periphery of a nuclear plant are less than if you spent for a year probably than if you spent a day at either Grand Central Station or the post office, which is also made of granite in Chicago. The levels are very low as far as its effect on causing cancer. We do have a lot of things that may cause cancer in our environment today. Some of you are smoking them. That's a very serious one. And many of you are using, for example, substitutes for cream with trans fatty acids in them, which we've known for 35 years. And you're eating a lot of margarine with trans fatty acids in it, which are also carcinogenic. And you're eating a lot of margarine with trans fatty acids in it, which are also carcinogenic. And you're eating a lot of other things that are carcinogenic. And on the scale of exposure, this figures in pretty small as far as a carcinogen, unless you're exposed to large amounts of radiation. And there you have to look at probably other sources of this, because the limits placed on radiation and radiation workers is among the most stringent there are.
You're saying by that radiation does have a relationship to cancer, but that nuclear power plants do not produce much radiation that reaches anybody.
That's right. But that's very true, or you couldn't open them up. And my exposure in working in radiation for 15 years at General Electric Company, where I had continual monitoring, I had far less radiation exposure there than I have had in the exposures I've had in going through veterinary school as far as medical radiology goes, and my own exposure to radiation outside of there, far less. And I worked with plutonium, and I worked with all kinds of radioisotopes and whole body radiation, but the requirements on me were so stringent. I mean, if I had a certain overexposure, I'd be put out of commission. I wouldn't be allowed to be exposed to it anymore.
I may add two words. If I had happened to spend a night in the desert next to a nuclear plant, you better go inside the nuclear plant than stay outside under the star, because if you stay all night outside on a clear sky, you get more cosmic radiation than if you go inside the power plant, because in the power plant you are shielded by 4 feet of concrete, which arrests all the cosmic radiation.
Yeah, and if you're really concerned about this kind of exposure radiation, as I mentioned the other night, you better live at sea level than living in Denver, you know, of any height, because the exposure is more. You certainly wouldn't want to live in Colorado, because it's double radiation exposure there for each year. Now, which ones? You've had your hand up a long time, and if we haven't addressed some of these others, yes.
I guess my feeling is that it's not any one of these single things, except perhaps proliferation of third world countries that are so bad in and of itself. You take all this total set of problems, of proliferation, terrorism, possibility of accidents, all these different things, and you say maybe nuclear energy isn't our ideal energy source. And the real thing that scares me, or what's really a problem as I see it, is the nation puts a tremendous amount of investment, manpower, government, bureaucratic especially, huge bureaucracy in place that has tremendous amount of momentum, as well as just financial. And what I see is that technology is advancing, and we will have better alternatives coming up. And we've heard many of them on the outskirts. What we need is more development of those something to tide us over until we can get better, cleaner, safer forms of energy, whether they be fusion, whether they be using waves in the ocean, temperature differentials in the ocean, the satellite that they talked about last night, solar power, indirect uses of the sun, in other words, indirect solar power that is clean, that is safe, and doesn't have all these problems associated with it. So we don't want to get so far into nuclear power that we can't back out when we find better alternatives. But we have to make sure that we place enough priority on these other things that they get developed rapidly.
I think he stated well something a couple of other you state as far as this momentum and all and the seem concentration in one area. And if we were to do it again, we'd probably back off and have tried to develop some of these others along the way, and maybe this one is pushed too fast. But we can't go back, you see. So what we have to do is go from here. The problem with this is, and I have sympathy for what you say, and I'm just now going to tell you what is in the minds of those who are in the position of authority and government. And whether it's here or other places, especially in the West. And this is also based on having talked with Jim Schlesinger within the last month. And hearing his presentation. Many of us can go back to Iran. And a year ago, or a year and a half ago, if I've told you what's happened in Iran, told you that was going to happen, most of you wouldn't have believed it. I wouldn't have either. And right now what's going on in Saudi Arabia, something there can also happen. And when that's cut off, what are we going to do? And what concerns the administrators and the legislators is that with the increase in population that will occur between now and 10 or 20 years from now, and there has been a prediction for how much energy we'll need, which I think was excessive. I have great sympathy that I wish, if I were dictator, if I could remove this demand for energy. But they made certain predictions, and none of these are going to be fulfilled by a long ways. There were certain coal plants and certain nuclear plants that were to be built. For the most part, they're behind schedule. Carter set out a certain plan that he'd cut down the utilization, but that coal would take up a certain percentage of it. And we're way behind schedule on that, because they have not allowed hardly any more, in many areas, any new development of any coal fields because of the stringent requirements for them. So we're not going to meet that. We're not going to meet it, certainly far, and nuclear. So we don't have any source of power, and I don't know where that is. You know, I don't know what the shortfall is going to be, but I think in 5 to 10 years it's going to be sufficient, if not before, and depending on what happens in Saudi Arabia, we are probably very near a revolution, certainly a great change in government. How many people do you have unemployed before you have a revolution or a change in government? Is it 15%? Or is it 20%? And this is what concerns them very seriously.
Neil, has in any of this discussion cost effectiveness been discussed? I'm aware that at the Monroe Reformatory, they put in the prisoners built with help of whoever, someone had a project going on it, a methane converter, where they took the waste products of the dairy farm there and converted it to natural wheat gas, which is a pretty good fuel. And this has also been done, I believe, in Los Angeles at their garbage disposal. I think that the technology is not complete on making it really cost effective, But I also don't think there's very much money going into research and improving our technology in that area. And we certainly, maybe not here at Holden as much as maybe at home, throw away a lot of stuff that could be easily turned into methane. Well, I say easily, with a fair amount.
Most of what you say is true. There is considerable knowledge relative to this conversion. There are quite a few projects on this. I think I would like to have Rudy or someone else discuss this. I think there has been cost-benefit analysis on it. As far as even if you went to totally utilizing all this, the percentage contribution to the energy requirement of the United States, I'm not knocking it. I think we should do this wherever we can to use every possible source of energy to conserve where we can so we don't have to have this. But I suppose the contribution to the national scene is maybe 1% or...
Yeah, it's a small percent, but the important point is that really it is not cost effective because we have held down the cost to the consumer of the fossil fuel, specifically oil and gas, which your congressman would not allow to come up to the world level. Just simply to protect the gluttony of the consumer. And the consumer elects the politicians, and they, so that the oil that's produced in America does not sell at the level. Now that means that other things are not going to be developed because they are not cost effective. So solar energy isn't developed because oil is cheap, gas is cheap, and it's kept cheap by Congress. And it's an artificial kind of thing that works against the best interest of the total population. And we condone this because we don't want to see it any other way. And so the real problem comes right back to us. We can change this, but we do not, at this point, really want to change it. And until it becomes a crisis, we'll not act.
I want to just call our attention to the fact that we've already gone over 15 minutes what I said we would, which means that I want to set people free to leave. I just didn't feel right setting people free in the middle of a revolution. It didn't feel
right. But I wish next time you'd have me talk about... the benefit of animals, bird watching, animal facilitated therapy, and things like that.
Any of you that would like to stay, however, I just want to set free people that want to leave, but I think if you want to stay a little bit more, still have some questions that are burning.
I'll stay here as long as you want me to, up to 11 o'clock.
All right.
Or until I fall asleep.
Anybody else free to leave? Yeah, question over here.
Just along that line, though, that's also hope, that the great hope that we hold out, is that as energy is increasing, and the price obviously is increasing, other things will become cost-effective. And all long projections we've made about what is not cost-effective are being outdated very quickly. One example is shale oil. Soon that's going to start becoming cost-effective, and we have a tremendous resource of shale oil.
One of the biggest problems with the cost effectiveness of, say, shale oil is the fact that when you process it and get out the oil that's in it, you have more waste than you had original product to begin with. And the waste product is really the thing that kills it. And you simply have nothing that you can do that we know of today. We're working on technologies to try and deal with that waste. But as it is, it isn't cost effective from the point of view of the environment. That's even worse than dollars. Mm-hmm. You know.
You can't measure cost in that.
And that's where the real problem is. And so shale oil, there is lots of oil in shale, but the cost to the environment, the cost to run, water, and the water cannot be spared.
Yeah. Most of it occurs in arid areas where they're having problems anyway.
That's right.
In the process, the stuff just takes mass quantities of water.
But yeah, that's true across the board. Still, I think the general point is true, that all of these other energy forms will become more and more cost effective.
Yeah, and one good example is if we can convert coal, and there are two pilot plants now going, of converting coal to sort of an oil, a heavy oil that will fuel a plant. And one prediction, I talked to a fellow within the last 2 weeks from Catalyst Company, and they predict $25 for a barrel. Mm-hmm. And the other plant is at 35. Well, you see, 25 produced in this country versus buying it from the Middle East.
But now it's at $23, so we almost balanced.
Yeah, and
the last Geneva price that came up.
That's right, that's very near. We're better off getting that for 25 here than buying it outside for 21.
Why not use grain?
Yeah.
There's a no waste problem there.
Well, Alan, you can feed it to the cows. The problem there, Al Halverson, is he here?
Yeah, Al's here.
You haven't said anything. Why don't you address the grain problem? There are some good and bad. Some of it is the cost.
Okay, if you're going to use grain to make alcohol, which I assume you're thinking about, grain, you can get about 2.5 bushels of alcohol, 2.5 gallons of alcohol from a bushel of wheat, maybe approaching 3. Wheat right now in Portland is selling for over $4.50. So you've got over $2 a gallon for alcohol right there. Then that's only the cost factor. Once you have produced the alcohol in the incubation process, what's the word I want here? Fermentation process. It takes most of a gallon of alcohol to distill off a gallon. So your net gain is so small it just doesn't pay. Almost all the alcohol we use today is produced from petroleum because it's so much cheaper. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to use grain directly as a fuel, that can be done. That's more efficient by far than converting it into alcohol.
Now, tell them what our plans are for steam engines at Holden. Tell them your idea for it.
Well, it seems to me that we're always thinking in terms of fuel as a liquid, something that we can put in our car and travel. Something that's convenient, and there are some instances, some uses for which we have to have a liquid fuel. But many of our energy requirements can be are in stationary units for heating, even stationary power units. We can use some of these things directly. Wood, waste material, straw, which can be ground into a powder form. And then it's essentially a fluid that can be handled in the same way that a fluid can. And this is one of the things we're thinking about doing here at Holden, is using steam power or fuel, taking wood waste and so on, making it into a powder, using it for heating. But you can use it if you've got heat, you can use it to heat a boiler, and you've got a steam engine, generate electricity, run a car, run a truck, and so on. So these are some of the things we've been talking about, thinking about doing here.
See, ground flour, 20 cents a pound, you'd probably do as well.
Let's go back to the waste. We have no waste problem. You can feed that.
That has to be figured into the equation as a benefit.
Yeah.
That you can feed that cattle. And you see, if you've read the Wall Street Journal within the last month, there are some farmers who have their own stills right now in Minnesota and other places.
It always have been.
Now they're running their tractors with it instead of giving it to themselves when they're out there in the winter on the tractor, and actually running their farm operation with it. The point is, of course, at the present time, what they're looking at is if they can't get it, you see. Then if you can't buy diesel fuel and gasoline, they're still in business, even though it's costing them more than if they probably sold it and bought gasoline. Isn't that true, Al, under the present market?
The other thing that can be done, you don't have to use alcohol or gasoline to distill off the alcohol from the fermentation vat. You can use solar, you can use corn stalks, which are doing back in the Midwest right now. There are other things that can be done, but it is awfully expensive. It's yet not cost effective in terms of, Rudy was saying, the low price that we're allowed to buy our petroleum at.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense that the government is beginning to say that we ought to be producing some of these synthetic things to mix with the gasoline to make it go farther, and to mix with the oil in various ways. And unless the government more or less dictates this or underwrites it, there's no way that I can see that it's going to get done within the economy. But in the long run interest of all of us, that kind of thing should be happening. I am hopeful that the Congress will get riled up enough, and that you people will rile them up enough. And the Arabs certainly are doing their best right now. They've raised the price of crude another 24%, you see, in the last week. So it's beginning to become cost effective to do some of these things that you couldn't get any of the politicians to move on.
And also, I wanted to point out that in the utilization of alcohol, of course, as far as the burning of it, it's a much cleaner fuel. That's an important consideration. In all of these analyses, I think it's very important that we be honest with ourselves. And I mentioned it the other night, to take it through from where you start to the finish. I don't care whether it's solar collectors or gasoline. And when seeing people are submerged and killed in an offshore oil rig, that's a cost that's very serious. Huh? Or it's black lung disease, or you go back to mining whatever it takes to make hafnium plates for solar, or the prediction on how many fall off their house when they're adjusting the solar plates. You can laugh about it, but they're just as dead. And there is no free ride. There is nothing without risk. Nothing without risk. As I mentioned the other night, coming here was no small risk today.
Just. It seems to me that behind everything is that in all the discussion is a tremendous commitment to, you know, what we commonly call the American kind of lifestyle.
That's right.
And it seems to me that what I hear happening is the genius of the nation is applying itself to a question of how do we supply the energy to maintain this lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And there is a very small number of, you know, geniuses who are saying nuts on that lifestyle. And you've used the analogy a couple of times about a revolution in this nation. And I think there are two greater scares, and that is a revolution in the world against this nation, or the opposite of that, kind of an alliance of the Western world to dominate the power sources. In other words, our getting smart and uniting with Europe and maybe even Russia and saying, we will maintain our lifestyle and make servants out of the rest of the world. And our politicians are already saying that. That the American people will go to war to keep their cars. Now it seems to me those are deeply far more moral issues than questions about, well, I think grain belongs in mouths, not in automobiles. There are priorities.
Well, looking at
garbage,
Chuck, looking at oil too, it really is a much too valuable product to be burning.
Exactly.
We shouldn't be burning petroleum. We should be making all the kinds of petrochemical things, including our medicine. A good part of our medicine now is based on petroleum.
And
why burn it up?
Yeah. No, you see,
the Arabs, instead of being demons, are the saviors, because they're taking our attention off of petroleum. They're forcing us into other areas. And they are getting into the cost spectrum kind of thing. They're saying, we got to make it while we can because it's going to run out.
Right.
And they're right.
yeah, there.
And we're not ready to admit that yet.
Well, I am.
The scientific technology of our land telling us that.
I have great sympathy for what you say, but I want to correct one thing. When I said revolution, I wasn't only concerned with a revolution here. I'm thinking of a revolution in the world. There is already a revolution underway. It is against us. It's been going on for quite a while, and it's justified.
Yeah.
And I am deeply concerned with what you are saying. And my concern is that most revolutions, including our own Revolutionary War, was probably not a good way to go. We could have got there without loss of life if we would have waited a little while longer, I think, and we would have accomplished the mission. Most revolutions end up with something worse than what you have. That is, the sudden ones. I've spent a lot of nights and early mornings thinking about how do we get at what concerns you. And I had some hope 3 or 4 years ago when we had a gasoline shortage. And I said, boy, we're going to wake up now, and we're going to cut back, and we're going into small cars and give up cars and go to bicycles. I happen to use a bicycle and walk most of the time. And maybe there's going to be hope. And we turned right around, didn't we? And we forgot all that. Now, let me finish two more sentences.
Okay.
What I was hoping was that if you lean on somebody long enough, pretty soon you can kind of move them and change them without getting into a big fight. But if you line up and really hit them, you cause a lot of damage. And I was hoping that this is how we could do it. A slow push and get to kind of come to our senses. I'm not too sure. Well, we don't know enough to be pessimistic.
I can be personal, and don't take this as an affront. You're a scientist, and I have great confidence in you. And you're concerned about what we're both talking about, in my mind, was aborted by your reference to technology will handle. Now, even with radiation rates, with the radiation waves, there seems to be the myth of technology solving all the problems. And with all of your concern, you contributed to the myth.
I still, in spite of what you say, technology can handle quite a few things. It saved a lot of lives medically. And it happens to be the area I'm most concerned with. And many of you would not be here had it not been for that technology, and many of your children would not have lived beyond 2 days of birth.
But technology is not salvation.
I'm the first one to...
I love technology. You know, the helicopter flies in and out today. We need that. It's significant. It's beautiful for us. But it's still not salvation of everything.
No.
And sometimes I think we wander into these kind of problems expecting technology to deliver.
Now, one of the great problems, as I see it in the world today, is that we, the fallout or outside, a byproduct of the technological world, the developed countries, the technologically proficient, is really the increase in population. And it is the medicine that has gone to the third world countries and all of the things that have saved lives. And so now the population is building up to the point where we really have accelerated the problem, and it's a part of our own problem. And we can't duck it and say that it's only their problem. It's our problem as well. And I think we can't forget that. We're like an airplane that's too far down the runway to not take off. We have followed technology to the point that we have to fly with it. And if we don't use technology at this point, there is no way to support the people that are living on the earth.
It's master versus servant, you see.
Yeah.
Is it master or servant?
That's
I want to say something now. First, I want to take an objection to the fact and to the speeches that we hear today that we have to lower the standard of American life. No. We have potentiality in this country to keep this standard of life only if we start working as a team, not wasting in bureaucracy or in just not useful speeches. Because if we have concentration of technology and not being scared of radiation or one thing or another, if we have to build up our potential energy on the future, which is on the nuclear energy. When you have plenty of electricity produced by nuclear energy, with this electricity we can produce synthetic fuel.
Hydrogen.
And, yeah.
Hydrogen from water and coal from, and carbon from coal, hydrocarbon. And it's the most pure, no sulfur, no phosphor, no pollutant.
I have trouble understanding why polluting the problem of research into other alternative methods of finding energy to the oil companies, you know, like the windfall tax. Okay, say they do come up with a method of solar energy. How are they going to get reimbursed for it? And they're the ones studying all the time, experimenting and trying to find resources. Once they find solar energy, then are they going to
tap into the solar panels every week or something? I mean, how are they going to get paid back for it? And why are we leaving it up to oil companies to do it? Mm-hmm. Does somebody want to address that? They're of course investing in it because
they're going to make money off of it. That's
because
right.
They're going to.
But are they
going to
make enough that they're really trying their hardest?
If you go to a central power station, if you're looking, for example, a solar collector apparatus, you're talking of something 5 miles by 5 miles, and the cost as well. It's way out of sight. I mean, it'll blow your mind. And then to get it up there, well, I suppose you'd assemble it up there, wouldn't you? You'd have to get your people up there to assemble it. And that's a fantastically, and then they'd have to get it down, so you'd have the transmission system down to a central point, and then you'd distribute it. So that's a lot of stuff involved, and it's a source.
I guess I don't know that would be the one we would need to do.
Yeah, and the other one, the one that I've observed is Sandia Base, that mock up there where they have a whole bunch of collectors going into a central point. And that would be is a mock-up, I suppose, of a large central station from which they would distribute power. So I guess.
See, one of the great technological problems with transmitting electricity, so you can't transmit electricity on a favorable basis for more than 300 miles, 400 miles, at the very most. You practically lose all of the efficiency through the lines or through the transmission system if you send it out 500 miles, correct?
That's correct.
So you have to have stations where the people are. And how do you do that? You know, and that's, there are lots of problems connected with it.
Paul, let me just make another comment in a little different vein here to kind of create another perspective on this energy thing. I had a secretary working for me a number of years ago who married a student from Tanzania. So when this fellow finished his work, he went back to Tanzania. They're living back there now. About in 1975, we had a letter from her. They were telling him, well, her question was, could I send her a copy of the blueprints that I had used to make a little solar stove, one that I had used to play with in my backyard to cook hamburgers and bacon and eggs and so on. Because, she said, after the oil price increased back in 74, the oil got so expensive they can't afford to buy oil back there. So they all went to burning wood. Now the wood's gone, we've got to have something else. That's where they are. That's another way of looking at this energy problem. She wanted the blueprint of that little thing that I had made just as a toy, made out of cardboard and aluminum foil. But if you have no more wood, what do you do? That's kind of the situation that's developed. And by the way, there are more people in the world that depend on wood for fuel than any other source of energy. More people, I didn't say more energy was used, but more people depend on wood than any other source of energy.
There was a man here a couple weeks ago, maybe it was a week and a half ago, that was with an oil company, and he goes around trying to get people to install solar panels.
Utility company.
Yeah.
Utility company.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And I have it right. I think he said that the reason he does, they hire him to do that because they're under obligation to supply the amount of power they need, not the amount they think they'll need, but what they need. So truly, the company has to supply that power, and it helps them to have people put in solar panels and whatnot. So that would probably be a reason why the oil companies would be looking into solar.
Well, we've had a complete turnaround, you know, in terms of advertising. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the oil companies, the gas and electric and all of them were, use more energy, you know, it costs less if you use more. You know, and now they really are in a position they can't supply it. And so they are on the other side of the fence, and they're pushing as hard as the rest of us. But everything from this point on has to be figured in terms of net energy rather than dollars. And you can't think of this problem in terms of dollars or in terms of convenience. It has to be on the basis of need and net energy. And when you say net energy, it's the total system. It costs a lot of energy to make a piece of metal. And wood, you see, is one of the least. If we could build our buildings out of wood. Aluminum is the most consuming of energy. It costs more energy to make aluminum than anything else. You know, so you have to think of what you're using up when in terms of energy, not just dollars and cents.
And yet we make our cars out of aluminum so they won't use as much fuel. Mm-hmm.
And airplanes couldn't fly, you see. You didn't make them out.
You mentioned cars, and wasn't it Moses in New York City said, once you get them in cars, you'll never get them out of them. That's one of our big problems.
Yeah, that's great.
That's kind of symbolic to me. One of the dismaying things about our whole conversation here is both how difficult it is for us to anticipate problems as a country and as a world, that in the space of 10 years we can move from that kind of advertising to the kind we have now. But behind that, our reluctance to be able to do what has to be done unless forced to, and until forced to, and when we're forced to, it's too late.
Paul, along that line, a fellow back here mentioned tremendous consumption of goods that we're engaged in and cutting back, changing our lifestyle to cut back. We must do it. I don't know how it's going to be done. And one of the reasons I say that, the law of the land, in effect, is that, the labor laws, the way the wages are determined, we have many so-called cost of living escalator clauses in many union contracts. If the price of something goes up, we're still going to continue consuming the same amount because our wages are going to go up so we can buy it. Now, that's part of the legal system in this country, the economic legal system. How do you get around that when that's in the law? And as was just mentioned, how do you cut back? We need to cut back. We're going to have to. Our other resources and oil are running out. But how do you get the people to do it? In effect, it's in the on the law books that we aren't going to.
I think we're at the point now where we can say one thing you do is you take the lessons of Holden Village home with you. Mm-hmm. possible to cut back here, and it's possible to press those concerns of other people, but I think we're at the point now where we can say that our task, and most of us here, we don't know anything about technology. We're not scientists. That's up to you guys to work as best you can in that area. But those of us who are concerned with the church and with moral questions can press the moral agenda with people, can try our best to get them to see the logic, the wisdom, and the imperative of that lifestyle question. And I think that's where our energies can be channeled. And it's crucial to do that in every possible opportunity.
This is one of the objectives and one of the goals that we're working at and for here at Holden. I think the rest of the committee would agree 100% on that.
That's exactly what we're all trying to do.
Yeah. I'd like to throw in one sort of interesting thing that's a little off what we're talking about, but I'm from Pennsylvania and I live 10 miles from Fremont Island. And the radiation from iodine there at the time of Fremont Island at the highest point. So, do you remember the bomb that China set off a couple years ago?
Yeah.
The radiation from that, the iodine radiation, was 50 times higher at its peak than it ever was from the nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
Just some perspective. At Harrisburg.
Which town are you from?
Can't go.
Well, I'm certainly glad we've solved all these problems.
All right.